LGIM Talks is produced by Legal & General Investment Management, providing you with the investment ideas we just can't stop talking about. This podcast assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets and is intended for investment professionals. I'm joined today by Eleanor Jukes, Senior Strategist in the LGIM Real Assets Division, here to talk to us about property and investing in alternatives. Eleanor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Really nice to be here, and what a great initiative.
Oh, thank you so much. We're very excited to talk all things alternatives and investing in property. Absolutely. So people are, according to your blog, property investors are starting to increase allocations to alternative sectors more and more. So what's behind this?
Well, I think it might be helpful for our listeners if we take a step back into history and think about right back in the 1980s when institutional property formally began through, as all good things, the construction of an index.
Of course.
So not that I want to name drop MSCI, but I have to because they are the proprietors of the index. But that was when the institutional property market started. Within that time, back in the 80s, people mostly invested in three core categories. So it would be shops or other forms of retail. It would be an office that we all know and love what an office is, or it would be some kind of industrial property. So either a big shed or perhaps one of those glamorous estates that you see located in some of the kind of provincial towns. And that was pretty much it. And then in IPD's eyes, everything else got bucketed into this unromantic named group called Other.
How imaginative that is.
Yes. I don't think they had a marketing team back in 1980s. And so it existed for about 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. But this other bucket decided to expand and to grow. And we realized that there was property out there other than shops, offices and sheds. And people became more and more interested in it, not least because some of the investment rationale behind that is quite different to some of these commercial properties that I've mentioned. So we have one of the things that we've been working quite hard within LGIM Real Assets is to say, well, it's life beyond other. And actually, it's life beyond alternatives. I find alternative quite a reductive term. Yeah. Because it's a bucket that encompasses many, many things. So I will probably get told off by our own marketing team for saying this, but it encapsulates what I like to say, cradle to grave investments. Yes, not just venture products. So it could be anything from nurseries. We will quite regularly look at nurseries, through schools, through student university halls, and also some of the university estates themselves. It encompasses a lot of different types of healthcare buildings. Mm-hmm. So that would be hospitals. We are the owners of some private hospitals, GP surgeries, a lot of care homes, and increasingly we are doing thinking around sort of the retirement living space, although have no exposure to that at the moment. And then I do know that some of our peer group institutional investors also own some graveyards. So within that bucket, yeah, there is a widespread of investments. So it's something, a really interesting area of the market, and lots of different clever thinking going on there at the moment. And we like to think that we're playing our part.
So what draws people to the alternative sector?
There's a number of, it's a very different space, but within that, there's a number of commonalities across those different types of alternative property. They have a tenant, usually, if we're there sort of in quite a traditional style investment structure. They, for various reasons, will take a long lease, so maybe 20, even 30, 40, 50 years in the case of some of the universities. Mm-hmm. That's very attractive to us as institutional investors who needs to be able to ensure that we have very stable cash flows because we need to match the liabilities and expectations of our shareholders. Where this is quite different to some of the commercial properties is that the average lease length of a commercial property is shrinking. So it used to be around 20 years. It's now less than 10. And particularly in some of the retail sectors, you might have a retail tenant who, when he wants to take a unit on a high street for 3-4 years. There's a big argument there that we can talk about another time, that you want to keep the high street fresh and keep those tenants dynamic. Mm. But equally, that needs to be balanced against our own requirements as an institutional property manager. So a lot of the other alternative property tenants do want to take a long lease. Yeah. They are quite often linked to an inflation index, so you will get a guaranteed level of uplift over the duration of the lease. But the really interesting area, at least for me as a strategist, is that the way that they behave compared to other types of commercial properties. So I don't like to use the words anti-cyclical or counter-cyclical, but they are definitely less correlated to the economy than perhaps a shopping centre or an office market, which is based on the labour market or resale sales. And again, that kind of brings back the idea of resilience and underpinning these stable cash flows that really speak to us and appeal to us as institutional investors.
So you've highlighted a lot of things that I would really love to delve into. I think the first one is how attractive it is to investors like ourselves and like many other long-term investors. How has allocations to alternatives changed over the years? How much have people moved out of the classic shared office storefront into alternatives?
Yeah, that's a great question. If you chart the index and the unromantically named other components of that, you will see that it's been steadily rising over the duration and horizon of that index. At the moment, it counts for about 17% of the commercial property universe that's held by institutional investors such as ourselves. But just a caveat, there are investors within the UK that don't fall within the index. So you get quite a lot of specialist funds who will only, for example, invest in healthcare property. But there's definitely a strategic movement towards allocating towards these different types of property investments. And it's quite interesting looking at the relativities of these other types of properties compared to your retail and your high street. And you can see that your average institutional investor is really tilting their portfolio now towards these more defensive sectors.
And that leads me on to my next question. Is that because of the income that's on offer, the inflation, above inflation income?
It's one of the reasons. As we move into this incredibly uncertain period of the market, you want to have a cash flow that is resilient. It makes sense from a diversification point of view. You've got a slightly more higher beta performing section of the market. You want to balance that out. But income is very important for property investors. If you look at the total return of your investment over a period of time, 60 to 70% of that return will be income. And by income, I mean rents.
Yeah.
So you want to have some certainty there that your rent is going to be paid over the duration of the lease and that it will be there sort of in perpetuity.
So talk to me a little bit more about this income resilience and how important that is to investors.
I mean, it's something that we've done a lot of thinking about as we enter this period of uncertainty in the markets. Just to try and draw some comparisons, if you look at the sort of the resale high street, about 14% of units on a high street are vacant.
Wow.
So you have voids. Yeah, it's incredible. And that's your kind of average high street. It's not your slightly more sort of wretched provincial high streets that I won't name any names. But there's void risk there, so you're not deriving an income on those units. But income resilience to us within real assets has a number of different factions. So it's about having those long-term counter-cyclical tenants, but it's also having a really good understanding of what your occupier wants. So within the offices sector, for example, we are now thinking more and more about flexible working and whether we want to work with our tenants to make sure that they have an element of flexibility in terms of the configuration and specification of the space. That means they want to be there longer. And again, it's about having those stable, resilient cash flows throughout the duration of your investments.
What makes these alternatives so resilient and insensitive to market changes? I would imagine everyone needs hospitals at any point in the market cycle, but what is that something that's across all of the alternatives?
It's, I guess you could break that down into two different themes. So you've just identified one of my favourite catchphrases at the moment, which is needs-based building. You heard it here first. So that would be your classic, your healthcare building, for example, or your schools, where you are providing space to fulfil an everyday life function, despite all the demographic change that I'm sure other speakers have talked to you about on different podcasts. There's always going to be a demand for care homes or for hospitals. That is one theme. The other is the structural changes that are happening within our day-to-day lives. So one of the funds within Real Assets is our Build to Rent fund. So this is came to life. It was born a couple of years ago. And its investment rationale is we build and operate purpose-built residential schemes within urban areas. It's quite a big change in the market. So the residential rental market prior to the early sort of 2000s was very fragmented. It was owned by your average buy-to-let landlord. There was no level of professionalism. It was all a bit sort of hit and miss. We saw a real gap in the market to provide a professional, institutional quality product, and have really led the market in terms of doing that gap analysis and providing a product that people want. And that's been a structural change in people's lifestyles. So it's your everyday to day demands, sort of meeting that demand in the care, in these space buildings. And it's also moving on people's thinking and sort of that sort of structural change in how they live their lives.
Absolutely. I guess you hear a lot about big asset managers who have these property funds investing a lot in the student housing. And that was a big story of the last few years. I mean, has that expanded? Has that developed further? Is that still a large part of this portfolio space?
Student accommodation is a really fascinating bit of, I need to stop calling it alternatives because I find it so reductive, non-commercial property. That's even less catchy. But traditionally, I mean, at least when I was at university, I was in halls in Nottingham, and I was paying £37 a week, which is incredible now.
Wow.
I know, and that wasn't that long ago, back in 1977. But it's similar to the sort of BTR build-to-rent market in that providers recognise that there just wasn't a high-quality product. The universities have arguably better things to do with their money than refresh their student halls. So we've now seen people like Unite and Nido really build and run some really good quality kit out there. And alongside this, we've had the change in students' perceptions and agenda, and they're much more consumer-led now. They expect to be given a high-quality education, and they want somewhere really nice to live. And importantly, for those people that own those buildings, they're happy to pay for that. And it's interesting thinking about some of the estate strategies for universities. So I was with the lead director from PwC yesterday talking about the student accommodation sector and how different the view is from universities on student accommodation. And some prefer to keep it sort of on their own books, if you like, particularly some of the collegiate universities, as would be expected. But the majority of universities recognise that having a nice, safe, rewarding place to live is a really important part of the student offer these days, and are happy to move it off their books. And there's an opportunity for institutional investors.
That seems to be a lot more the case in cities, certainly expensive cities such as London, where, I mean, ground rent in London is not cheap. Yeah. And therefore, does that offer a good opportunity for institutional investors to come and fill that space?
Well, interestingly, if you look at the supply-demand ratio for London, it suggests that actually London is still relatively undersupplied with purpose-built accommodation. But there's other markets where that ratio is perhaps looking a little bit unfavourable. So one of the big jobs that I do within my role at Real Assets is to try and get a really good understanding of local market dynamics. Mm. What does the supply and land ratio look like now? What it's going to look like in the future? Do we have good relationships with the universities where we could put an agreement in place to ensure that we get the sort of a good continuity of students over the duration of the lease? But it's certainly an area that we remain positive on, despite some of the headlines that have been in the press recently about falling student numbers.
Yeah.
That's counterbalanced by the increase in international students and you know, lifelong learning. So it's an area that we remain very positive on.
Interesting. And those kind of leases are over what time period?
It would be dependent on the university or the agreement with the accommodation provider, but it could go up to anywhere between 20 to 50 years. So they are really long.
Very long term.
Yeah. But that just goes to reinforce my point that you need to know your market. And to be a responsible investor, you really need to have a good understanding of what it's going to look like in 50 years' time.
So how can investors who choose to allocate to these alternatives kind of avoid the kind of portfolio construction concentration risks that come alongside that?
I mean, there's different ways of allocating your capital. So you could either look at it in diversification terms and say, well, I'm going to put some into sort of the more annuity-style products, whether that's the long-term lease with the university or a care home. One of the other, I find, really exciting areas of the market is where institutional investors are taking what we call operational risk. So instead of it just being a traditional lease where you're paid your rent every quarter, hopefully. instead, it's what's known as an operational lease. So you will own the building and you will have a third-party operator in place. So to give you an example, we now own the H by Hilton Hotel, which is located right next to Stansted Airport.
Right.
On the runway, you will see it if you've flown out of Stansted. We own the building and we have a third-party operator in place who runs the hotel day-to-day. And then we have a name above the door and a franchise agreement, which is Hilton. What's interesting about this structure is that what we take home, or what the revenue we generate, is the net operating income. Mm-hmm. So it's not rents, it's the revenue after costs. And this is uncapped. So whilst it could go down, it's mm-hmm. also uncapped at the top end. So it's a really interesting bit of the market, and one that it's taken us a long time to get comfortable with,
yep.
In terms of what the parameters are in terms of those revenues. But it's an area where we think the market is heading, as some of those big corporate tenants look to be a bit more asset light and want to be a bit more nimble and are happy with the franchise agreement. So I guess it goes back to my point about we are evolving our investment strategy, whether that's offering a build-to-rent fund or offering an operational lease.
I mean, that sort of model gives the potential for a hefty amount of uplift, one would imagine. Mm. How would you in your day-to-day evaluate the risks of such opportunities?
There's a number of different ways that I will conduct due diligence with our fund manager and our transactions team. So part of that is being absolutely certain in the fundamentals mm-hmm. of the site. So just going back to my example of the hotel in Stansted Airport, it was almost a monopolistic position because of the runway in the airport. No one is going to build another hotel there. but we also knew that there was going to be a very steady flow of passengers through there. And we were confident that it was going to be a long-term place. Stansted's not going anywhere. We also did a huge amount of due diligence on the operator themselves. So that was just combing through line by line their projections and cross-checking everything. And then we also have a wonderful fund analyst back in Real Assets who mm-hmm. did lots of scenario, worst case, best case analysis. So what if this is security incidents? What if the lift breaks down? What if the boiler blows up? What if they build a second, third, fourth, fifth runway at Stansted? You know, yeah. And it was from those that we were able to start to put some ideas and structure around where the revenues could go. But as with any different kind of forecast, it's a projection, nothing more.
Even so, that kind of level of due diligence and scenario planning must put a lot of the long-term investors who, you know, come to you for these ideas, must put them a lot better at ease for having considered this other. I imagine the title Other Alternatives puts off a lot of people in the way they might understand alternatives in the traditional investment space of being perhaps commodities. Mm. There's a connotation that goes with alternatives for being riskier. And do people come with that kind of misconception to the property market?
Yeah, that's a good, interesting question. I was going to say it's got an image problem, but I don't actually agree with my own statement. I think there's definitely an educational piece there. Mm. So when we're out there talking to our clients and talking to other investors or potential investors in the market, you'll find that certain groups and certain countries know sort of different areas of the market. So some of our Asian investors are very knowledgeable about hotels, mm-hmm. but then are less knowledgeable about healthcare and its role within the UK and how it's very different to the US, for example. So there's definitely an educational piece there, but it's an area that people are becoming more and more aware of as the market moves that way, and expect us to be able to provide them with those kind of assets.
Talk to me a little bit more about these kind of investors who really kind of direct their, within the alternative space, direct their interest and energies towards the kind of very purpose needs-based buildings. What's drawn them to these particular areas? Is it because they understand the sector more in the case of hotels, for instance, or is it a moral basis of like, we really want to build healthcare more long-standing societal benefiting buildings?
I mean, you would hope it would be both. Mm. I mean, in the instance of Real Assets and the wider L&G group, we have a very embedded mantra that our long-term patient institutional capital needs to match the requirements of society. And the alternative sectors, whether that's a school or a student hall or a purpose-built residential unit, are meeting those societal needs. And we are providing purpose-built, professionally managed buildings to better suit their lifestyles. So there is a very strong social theme there that we underpin our investment strategy with. But then there's other players within their space who are very niche and do what they do incredibly well. So it's looking at their best practice and overlaying it with our wider social mantra.
So I was going to draw this to a close by asking, how does alternatives sit the near-term outlook for alternatives versus something like retail, where you see a lot of, you know, dark headlines? And you mentioned it earlier, 14% vacancy rate. Perhaps Can you explain a little bit more about its position now in the near term?
I think, I mean, as I said, about 17% of the institutionally owned universe at the moment goes towards that other non-commercial bucket. We would expect that to increase over time because it's meeting those long-term societal needs. Our own house view is that if you were going to rank the commercial and non-commercial sectors, alternatives are there at the top because you've got those long-term cash flows being underpinned by the needs of society. And against that, some of the more traditional sectors are falling away, particularly the instance of retail. The one exception to that is the industrial sector, which is another really hot area of the market, very much underpinned by the kind of e-commerce strategy.
Is that logistics, perhaps, the fulfillment centres?
Exactly, yes. You've been reading your market reports. But some really interesting tech innovation going on in that space where it's automated and cross-docking and all the other words I don't really understand, but I know are impressive. But our house view is very much that alternatives are going to be outperforming over the sort of the next 5 years.
I feel it would be a bit reductive to say that what we're saying here is ditch the future of commercial properties is done, everything into alternatives from here on out.
Absolutely not. There's always going to be a place for a shop on a high street or for a supermarket. I mean, arguably, that's a needs-based building in itself. We are sat in an office building today. That's not going to go anywhere. We are social beings. We're never going to just sit in our homes, even if they are purpose-built, professionally managed. It's about having a balanced portfolio and balancing the risks and the rewards.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Eleanor.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if you'd like to find out more about Eleanor's thoughts on the subject, be sure to visit the Future World blog, where she has written the article, Property Moving On From the Mainstream. And we've linked to it in the show notes, but you can also find it on the blog website. Thank you very much for joining us. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.